Il-program li ser tisimaw uwa miġjub lilkom bi xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year.
University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Alan McFarlane. Just a few words about my guest. Professor McFarlane was actually born in Assam in India in 1941. He was educated at the Dragon School in Sebra in the county of Cumbria today. I imagine at that time it was probably the West Riding of Yorkshire. And at Worcester College, Oxford, where he gained his MA and DPhil. Also went on then to the London School of Economics and the School of African Studies, where he gained a PhD. Although he was an Oxford man, his career as a university lecturer started at the University of Cambridge, lecturing social anthropology, reader in historical anthropology, professor of anthropological science, and then he became emeritus professor from 2009. At King's College, Cambridge, he was a senior research fellow in history between 71 and 74, Fellow between 1981 and 2009, and then Life Fellow from that date onwards. As an anthropologist and historian, he has worked on England, Nepal, Japan, and China. He has focused on a comparative study of the origins and nature of the modern world, which was partly the subject of a recent talk he gave, and I hope we'll have time to discuss that. In recent years, he's become increasingly interested in the use of visual material in teaching and research, and his recreations are gardening, second-hand book hunting, a passion which I share with him, walking, and also filming. Welcome to University Matters, Professor.
Thank you.
Perhaps we could start off with a general question about your attraction to anthropology at the start of your career. You say in one of your biography documents that at Sedbergh, at sixth form, you became enamoured of poetry and history. How did that then translate into anthropology?
Well, I'm a son of the Raj. As you mentioned, I was born in Assam, Shillong in Assam, and my parents and 12 generations of my ancestors at least have been all over the British Empire, China, South America, everywhere. And I think the shock of coming back as a six-year-old to a very, very cold North Oxford, coldest winter of the 20th century, and then the coldness of English social customs and culture, and having to learn how to be a British middle-class boy from that background in India, meant that my friends, when I asked them about what I was like when I was about 10 or so, they say you were always on the edge of the group, watching it, sort of slightly anxious and observing. And I think I learnt very early on that different cultures have different customs and they're all interesting, but you have to learn them. Also, I went back to India when I was about 11 to see my parents, who were tea planters, and also when I was 16. And the shock of seeing Calcutta at the age of 16 made me feel I really ought to go back and try and do something about the poverty that I saw then. And also increasing interest in the hill tribes of around the area where I was born. So when I was just finishing my MA at Oxford and wondering what subject to do, I chose a subject, witchcraft, in 17th century England. And I was sent to be supervised by a brilliant young fellow at St. John's, Sir Keith Thomas, who said, well, Alan, if you're going to study witchcraft, you ought to go and listen to anthropologists and talk to them, because they've done all this work on it. So I got to know the great generation of Oxford anthropologists, like Evans Pritchard, who'd worked on witchcraft. And halfway through my DPhil in history, I went to see him and I said, I'm really getting more interested in anthropology than history. Should I change subject? And he said, no, finish it off. And so I did, and then I retrained, as you mentioned, at the LSE and SOAS. So basically, I don't actually see any difference between history and anthropology, except in method. They should be about the big questions And in order to answer the big questions, which is what are we like and where did we come from and what is the origin of our world and what is its nature, you have to combine the two. Sometimes you need the evidence. And I've also, you need to combine the evidence really from anywhere you can find it. So I'm also interested in demography and population. I've written books on political philosophy. I've written books on tea, on glass, on, you know, anything. We can't understand our world without knowing about tea or glass or family life, whatever. So that's it.
I think that during your time at SEBRA, I think, if I understood correctly, your grandmother was around in that area and brought you, more or less brought you up while your parents were abroad. And having that kind of, she had a sympathetic attitude towards the East and India, of course, and being a foot in both camps, I mean, that must have been a great help to you.
It was a great influence. My grandmother was a very formidable lady. Her son was a well-known British politician, nearly prime minister, but he didn't quite make it. And anyway, he was only 7 years older than me, so he was my kind of older brother, and I was brought up by this proxy mother who had been a redoubtable figure in the Raj. Her family went back for 10 generations in the Raj, late 18th century lawyers buried in the Calcutta Old Graveyard and so on. So the family, and my grandfather was a colonel in the Punjab Regiment in India, and my uncles fought in Burma during the war and so on. The family was just endless Raj all over the world. They ran the British Empire in a very minor way. And I heard these stories, and I was surrounded by these objects, you know, gold boys looted from the palace of King Tibor when he was thrown out by the British, one of the only three gold boys, which I now have. I was surrounded by Raj objects, Raj memories, and my own infant memories, and therefore I was intrigued in all this, and my mother was very involved in writing about this as well, and she wrote to me every week describing the world of Assam in India and keeping that all alive. So all these things together threw me towards anthropology.
Before going into those fascinating places that you visited as part of your anthropological research, you did also do quite a bit of work actually in England. Your witchcraft research was, I think, England-based. Mm. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I did start off as an English historian. I started with witchcraft, but it was a revolutionary period in English social history. It was the great period of Marxist and other social historians, E.P. Thompson and so on. And also the archives were suddenly becoming available. There was more money in the local archives. So I was in this wonderful position of having a new theoretical framework from anthropology and having these vast, as yet unseen, archives of the 16th, 17th, 18th century on which to investigate new things. So I was part of what was known as the new social history, influenced by the French and the Annales school, and particularly local history. And so my wife and I did the longest and deepest study ever made of an English village for 500 years, assembling all the local documents, which are all on the web now. Also, because I felt sort of an outsider and an insider, I sat down and wrote my most famous academic book, which is called The Origins of English Individualism, published in 1977, which I rejected the whole theoretical paradigm of my teachers and historians at that time, the Marx Weber framework for the origins of the modern world. It was a very short book which caused a huge controversy, and by which I'm best known among historians. Half of them agreed and half violently disagreed. And
so the jury's still out?
Not in my mind. No, like all good paradigm shifts, they all protest that I was wrong, but they have all accepted it, so it's over now. Most of them accepted it. So basically, I was a historian of England. I wrote about marriage and love in England, law and violence in England, many English subjects. And our children were growing up, and I couldn't go back and do the repeated fieldwork, because I'd done one bit of fieldwork in Nepal until they were grown up, and then I went back and became more of an anthropologist.
The idea of witchcraft is always, people have loved fascination about it, but you gave it a real explanation. Perhaps you could tell us very briefly what that explanation for it was.
Well, it was really quite a simple idea that just flashed on my mind as I was walking around in the Lake District looking at the hills and the fells. And this was that if you look at a particular case where an old lady comes to your house and you've been sort of friends, she's a neighbour, she's poorer than you, and she comes quite frequently and asks you for a bit of salt or a tool or something, and you've always said, yes, here you are. And then you're getting fed up with this, and your family is saying, why do you keep being nice to her? So you say to her, sorry, I haven't got any salt. And then as you look at her, her face changes, and you suddenly think, she looks angry, she looks malicious, she looks... Didn't I hear a story that she was sort of person who, if you got her angry, she could do something to you? Then she goes away, and next day your child falls ill, and you remember this, and you connect the two events, and you talk to your neighbours, and they say, yes, it happened to me too. And then you take her to court, and she's punished. So it's the sort of feeling people have when they say no to a beggar, you know, a feeling of guilt and going against your own ethical standards, and yet, you know, you've got to preserve yourself. So it's a conflict. And so one of my explanations was that it was to do with this ethical conflict and the transition from a Catholic society, which had made it traditionally necessary to help your neighbours and so on, to a more Protestant individualistic world. Now that further interpretation and the basis of it I later questioned, and I'm not sure it was absolutely right, but there is some element of that. And nowadays we can still do this. We all know that we have friends or countries which live nearby and they seem extremely nice, and then something happens and they look extremely unnice. So it's a psychological...
It's easy to demonize.
Demonize, yeah, and we still do it.
A friend of mine once told me that he was never as happy as when he was sitting on the balcony of his house in Nepal, looking out towards the mountains. He said it gave him a sense of inner peace that he could never find elsewhere. From your writing, it's clear that Nepal had a great influence on you and was somewhere that you returned to refine yourself. How did, paraphrase your own words, did Nepal put everything in perspective and refresh parts of the mind and body which neither England or Japan can touch?
Well, I think there must have been a number of things. And many people like your friend have this feeling, but it was probably strengthened with me in various ways. Firstly, the first 5 years of my life was in that, with those smells and sights and sounds, very similar along the Himalayas. And I was brought up by Ayas, who were Nepali-style hill women. They were Garos and Khasis rather than Gurungs, but they had the same eyes, faces, smiles, sweet temperaments. So I was going back to a society which was very familiar in many ways, and I was going into a world where it might not be as efficient, and it might not be as rich, and it might not be this and that, but it hadn't gone through the draining of emotion and meaning of life that you have in many parts of the West. In particular, the family system was very strong. I was adopted into a Gurung family, so I had an alternative set of kin. So when I went back each time, there were all these children, grandchildren, nephews, nieces. They all ran up to you and hugged you and said, it's lovely to see you. And you suddenly were in a family world, so you'd rejoined the communal world, which we tend to have to lose. Just to give you a small example, a funeral in the West, you know, is a terribly unsatisfactory business, certainly in my country. You know, you go, you say you're sorry the person has died, you have an hour or two, you have the service, and you go away, and you're left with this deep sense of guilt and bewilderment. There, I've just been to a funeral there, or a memorial service. It goes on for 3 days, and there were 500 people there for 3 days. You dance, you sing, you drink, and you get it all out of you. So emotionally, it's much richer. I couldn't live there because I would miss, and I did miss, the libraries and the ideas and the books. But I found a kind of backwards and forwards is enormously refreshing.
A friend of mine who's a professor of philosophy here at the university was saying that in Nepal there's this sense of love your neighbour, without wanting something back, which is very strong. He wasn't quite sure why it was like that, but that's how he felt, that it was feeling of there was a reciprocal respect without wanting to have gain out of it. Would you say that that's true or not?
It varies. I mean, in certain Brahmin villages, you hate your neighbours and don't trust anyone, and you can become over-sentimental about these things. There is often a motive and reason. But you can see, and I've watched it at close quarters, neighbours and others asking for favours and so on in a Gurung village. I mean, in the end, you can have short-term reciprocities where you don't give to someone unless you think you're directly going to get it back from them. But in a community like that, where you've got 500 people battling against the elements and against trying to farm on the edge of a very steep, the steepest Lake District mountain, or steeper, bigger than Scarfell Pike, if you don't have a distributed set of reciprocities, when you have something, then you share it with someone else, and then when you have a need, you go to someone else. These go in circles, not directly with your neighbour, but another neighbour. Unless you have that strong set of altruistic activities, it's much more like a football team. I mean, basically, you have to work together, you have to pass the ball to someone else, or you have to rely on people you just can trust to rely on. And a narrow, egocentric, one-to-one reciprocities and bargains and contracts don't hold the place together, and it wouldn't work like that.
What about the poverty? Was that something that, when you first went, struck you very much? Or what kind of life do they lead? You were saying that it's a difficult farming life, but there's a difference between grinding poverty and subsistence farming.
Mm. Well, these people were not nearly as poor as many people in the Himalayas, because many of them had traditionally been recruited into the Gurkha regiments of the British Army. So there were pensions and money coming back in. Their houses were more substantial and their food was better. And they've remained relatively well off because of this, and now with labour in the Gulf and elsewhere. So they weren't destitute, people didn't starve, and even the poorest weren't that poor. The work was intolerably hard. We couldn't possibly do it. Children and women carrying burdens we couldn't lift off the ground, and working for long hours in a way which no one in Malta could do now, or anyone in England really. So they worked far harder, as the Japanese and others did. It's usually the case in rice agriculture, it's very difficult, but this is on a gradient of 1 in 3, and with no wheels and with no transport and no animals to carry anything, so you have to carry everything and do everything with your back and arms. So for some months of the year, it's really gruelingly hard. But poverty, as you know, is very difficult to measure. If you just take the gross index, were these people happier? Did they smile more? Did they have more meaning in their lives and seem to lead a richer life than my friends who were 50 times richer in England? The answer is obviously these people were happier. They smiled more, they seemed more contented. And what you realize, which is an old anthropological lesson, is that poverty is largely about the relations between means and ends. If you have certain limited desires and you can easily, reasonably achieve those, and you're not constantly being pushed on to have more and more desires, then you feel contented and you don't necessarily feel poor. And if people don't look on you as poor, you don't consider yourself poor, then you're not poor. Whereas many people in the West have this constantly rising set of expectations, and they can never meet them, and they feel relative deprivation, relative poverty. I mean, it's quite absurd to me. Our politicians are constantly telling us that this recent recession has thrown us back into the 1920s, and that, you know, we're in the more dire straits than we've ever been, and the middle class is being crushed and so on. They just should spend an hour or two in another part of the world, and they'd see what material poverty really is. We live in such affluence. I mean, Malta is just oozing with wealth.
For an anthropologist, like yourself, who does field work in faraway places. Going home must always be a bit of a bittersweet experience. You mentioned that you missed the libraries and that kind of thing. What was it like going back then to the rarefied atmosphere of a Cambridge college? How did you manage that change?
Well, the first shock is when you arrive in Heathrow. It's not so much now, but because Kathmandu is not dissimilar to the West now, but in the older days, you know, everything worked and was efficient and so on. But my wife and I used to say it's like walking into a cotton wool world. Suddenly, all around you was a deadening. You didn't say hello to people who were sitting next to you on the bus or anything. It was just suddenly you were in a little cocoon. When I went back to King's or Cambridge, it's true that for a day or two it felt completely crazy and strange there, and that's why I've written a book about Cambridge, to try and explain it to people who don't know it, because it is a very topsy-turvy, strange sort of world, an extreme form of it. And for a while I'd possibly lost the codes a little bit. I'd become a little culturally deaf, and so I didn't pick up a few things, and I couldn't see the main thing, as you know, most people feel this after holidays, a loss of meaning. I mean, before you went, you were quite contentedly doing all sorts of things. When you come back, there's a period of a day or two when you can't think why you should do that thing. And what's the point of it? And you sit around, and it takes some energy to get back into the meaning of your life. And this was a bit extreme in an academic setting. The seeing your first students and someone could be quite stressful. You'd forgotten the books that they should be reading, and you'd forgotten what your subject was. But after a few days, it all comes back.
One of the things you talk about in one of the documents that I happened to find on the website was about organising your vast collection of books, papers.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm, says he boastfully, but I'm one of the leading experts in the world on computer archiving systems, because my wife and I worked on them for the history of this English village. And so from 1973 I've been working with computer scientists on information retrieval systems. We wrote some of the leading ones. We anticipated HTML, WIMP screens, probabilistic retrieval systems such as Google. We'd written all these things before. It was in my basement that Bill Gates first saw the internet, or the intranet as it was called in Cambridge.
Wow.
So we were ahead of anywhere in the world, and I'd made the first multimedia video disc and so on. And I've always, I suppose because I've been piling up paper, I've never thrown anything away since I was 16. So I have 200, 300, 400 filing cabinets of papers and thousands of photographs and all these family archives which I've inherited from all over the world, and 2,000-3,000 hours of film I've taken all over the world and photographs. Now, in order to control all this, for instance, all our Japan films, China films, Nepal films, family films, I've filmed my granddaughter growing up and so on, you need a very good retrieval system and archiving. So, although of course I lose things all the time, on the whole, I have a barn and an archive, and I can more or less find anything. The system is so powerful that, for example, if I want to find a bit of film of a little girl having her feet washed in 1987, I can find that immediately through the computer system. And I'm developing all this. All this is ahead of what anyone else in the social sciences has done. And I'm now working with Chinese universities to export this methodology and set up centres in China where they will use this to archive their own society.
Yes, as I was reading your description of how you developed this over the years, I was thinking of my measly little bookshelves and how I never seem to manage to find what I want. I'm thinking, gosh, I think I should be reading some of Professor McFarlane's books on this, definitely. Just in the last couple of minutes that we have, obviously, you can't put your talk that you gave, the public talk that you gave, in a nutshell in 2 minutes. But it was I loved the idea, something I had never thought of myself, the idea of this East-West divide and your explanation for it. Mm. The Industrial Revolution sort of missing a missing chunk or, from the Chinese history. Can you just describe it in a few words or not?
Probably. The first great divergence was from oral tribal societies, the invention of writing, and then the invention of great philosophies, which swept right across Eurasia and were similar in the east and the west of Eurasia. So until about 1400-1500, much of the basic knowledge of different parts of Europe and Asia were the same. From about 1500, they diverged because of the scientific revolution and the Renaissance. And this was exacerbated in the 18th, 19th century with the Industrial Revolution. So that by the time of Deng Xiaoping's opening up of China in 1982 onwards, China was still basically at about 1400 in its knowledge systems and its technologies. It hadn't really changed. It was pre-industrial and it was pre-scientific and pre-Renaissance. So in the last 30 years, the Chinese have not only had to completely reconstruct their economy, their legal system, their social system, their cultural system, but also their knowledge system. They've had to go through the whole philosophical system from Plato up to Derrida and Foucault in one generation, which is what they're doing pretty effectively. So there was a huge divergence and it's just come together in 30 years. And so Confucianism is now mingling with postmodernism in China.
Wonderful explanation in a very short time. But there is a recording of your talk and I hope other people will have a chance. Those who didn't manage to attend it will have a chance to hear it as well. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you very, very much, Professor Alan McFarlane, for being with us to talk about anthropology and your career today.
Thank you for your question.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.